In 1962, a 22-year-old grad student at Cambridge predicted a mind-blowing superconductor phenomenon. His prediction paved the way for a new type of superconductor-based circuit capable of switching at incredible speed. For 15-plus years, IBM tried to use these concepts to make a computer. It didn't work. In this video, we look at IBM's failed superconductor computer. But first, this video is brought to you by the Asianometry Patreon. Early Access members get to see new videos first and selected references for those videos. Early Access really helps me a lot, and I appreciate every pledge. Thank you, and on with the show. I did a whole video about superconductivity back during the LK99 hype. I recommend that you watch it. At room temperature, a superconductive material exhibits electrical resistance, meaning that it impedes the flow of an electrical current. For some materials, the resistance might be quite high. But when the material reaches a low enough temperature, the transition temperature, the resistance falls to zero. Yes, actually zero. You can suspend a current inside a superconducting ring, and it will stay there for an indefinite period of time. No resistance. It will also float on a magnet. This superconductive state only exists in certain circumstances. Not only a low enough temperature, but also a weak enough magnetic field and current density. If a magnetic field appears, then the transition temperature goes down further. Concepts for a computer based on superconductors have been around since the 1950s. Back then, the world's research institutes were using vacuum tubes as switches for a digital computer. However, these tubes were not small or reliable enough. In late 1955, Dudley A. Buck, an electrical engineer who left the U.S. National Security Agency for MIT, proposed the cryotron. Cryotrons are superconducting switches, switching their superconductivity on and off. The first cryotron was very simple, just a segment of tantalum wire with another copper wire wound around it. You then dip the whole thing into very cold liquid helium, which causes the inner tantalum wire to go superconductor. An electric current can now flow through it without resistance. So how do you switch it off? You push a current through the winding copper wire, creating a magnetic field that pushes down the transition temperature enough so that the tantalum wire exits the superconductive state. This is quite similar to the field effect transistor, except it uses a current rather than a voltage as the control signal. The cryotron was not only far smaller than existing transistors or vacuum tubes, it could be easily fabricated. Buck and the media envisioned superconducting circuits powering computers as small as, quote, a cubic foot, exclusive of refrigeration and terminal equipment, end quote. Buck continued development on the cryotron throughout the decade, but he unexpectedly passed away in 1959 in Massachusetts at the young age of 32, apparently from a viral pneumonia or an edema resulting from the gases he was working with. Cryotron development continued for a little bit after Buck's death, and industry people showed good progress. A team at IBM created a thin film version that switched far faster than Buck's original. And a team at GE was able to put some 2,000 superconductor switches onto a single integrated circuit, far beyond what anyone else had done before, and make a computer from it. However, the invention and subsequent growth of the silicon planar integrated circuit offered superior performance without the need for liquid helium refrigeration. The industry receded into the background. In 1961, a theoretical physicist named Phil Anderson visited the Royal Society Mond Laboratory at Cambridge on sabbatical. Anderson himself would win the Nobel Prize in 1977 for his contributions in solid-state physics. In any story about superconductors, seems like every character has won a Nobel. Anyway, while at Cambridge, Anderson taught a course on solid-state physics, discussing an idea known as broken symmetry and its connection to superconductivity. The idea of symmetry in physics is an important one, and what follows is a radical simplification. If a statue is standing upright, you should expect it to stay standing upright until something acts on it. The statue is not going to suddenly flop over. This should be the case no matter how we translate that system, meaning no matter where the statue is, a translation in space, and no matter when it is, a translation in time. The laws of motion, ergo, are symmetrical in terms of space and time. There are many types of symmetries within physics other than just the laws of motion. This was a tough concept for me to grasp at first, so feel free to stop and Google for additional info if you need it. Anderson proposed broken symmetry as a way to explain how atoms can sometimes collapse into a lower energy state that do not exhibit the same symmetry as the laws of physics acting on them. He uses this to explain how electrons in a metal form what we call Cooper pairs when a metal enters a superconducting state. This unusual pairing would not normally happen in a non-superconducting state, thus breaking a symmetry of electromagnetic interactions. Did that make sense? I hope it did. Anderson also invoked this broken symmetry theory to try to explain how a superconducting material can expel a magnetic field, the infamous Meissner effect. Photons inside the superconductor suddenly gain mass, expelling the field. Inspired by the concept of broken symmetry, one particularly bright student in Anderson's graduate class named Brian Josephson began trying to see if it could be observed in an experiment. Josephson began studying several experiments and came across a few recent ones on superconductor tunneling. Tunneling is when a single electron or pair of electrons pass through a barrier that would have ordinarily stopped them. It's a quantum mechanics thing, so only practically observable when the dimensions are very small. A 1960 experiment by Ivar Gaever showed that single electrons can tunnel through very thin barriers, like just 20 angstroms wide, from one superconductor to another. Josephson tried to formulate a theory of equations to fit this behavior. As he tried to explain the behavior of electrons traveling from one superconductor to another, he discovered something startling. Let us imagine a circuit with a junction or barrier made of some insulating material in between two metal superconductors. Let us now put this circuit into differing situations. If the barrier is thick, then we cannot send any current through from one side to another. This is the case no matter how much voltage we apply to this. Classical physics dominate here, not quantum mechanics. Recall that voltage is like the pressure for the current. It is kind of like how water pressure pushes water through a pipe. Now let us shrink the barrier to a very thin width. Per the well-known tunneling principle from quantum mechanics, this thinness grants us the possibility that a single electron can tunnel through that thin barrier to the other side. We apply more voltage, we get a directionally proportionally stronger current tunneling through. Now let us start lowering the temperature. As the system approaches the transition temperature for a superconductive state, we see this directly proportional voltage-current relationship start to break down. Now we are in a superconducting state. So long as the current is below a certain threshold, we see that current flow through what is normally an insulating barrier without resistance. No voltage or pressure necessary. But if the current breaches that current threshold, or if a magnetic field is applied, the supercurrent collapses. The barrier regains its resistive properties, and everything is as before. This very strange behavior is what we now call the Josephson effect. What Josephson is saying that is new and radical is that it is not just single electrons quantum tunneling through the barrier, but entire Cooper pairs carrying their superconductive abilities along with them. The supercurrent flows like as if the insulating barrier was not even there. Josephson's paper set off a rush of people to verify his predictions, which few people believed. Even John Bardeen, co-creator of BCS theory and one of the discoverers of the first transistor, could not believe it. The two famously debated. But then in 1963, a set of experiments verified the Josephson effect. Bardeen graciously withdrew his objections, and Brian won the Nobel Physics Prize in 1973, alongside the aforementioned Ivar Gaever and the semiconductor pioneer Leo Isaki. Josephson was just 33 years old at the time. The Josephson effect's ability to move between a zero-voltage superconducting state and a normal resistive state forms the basis of a digital switch. We can use the levels of voltage to represent states of logic, like ones or zeros. A high voltage state can be like a one, and a low voltage state can be like a zero. After the Josephson effect was experimentally verified, IBM began working on building a thin film device for possible use in digital computers. In order to differentiate this device from the quote-unquote failed cryotron, IBM's Juris Matisu decided to give it a new name, the Josephson Junction. Early devices were made up of two pieces of lead, or niobium, chosen for their relatively high transition temperatures, separated by a very thin insulating oxide barrier. One of the earliest examples displayed was a flip-flop memory circuit. A memory cell has to retain a bit, 1 or 0. DRAM memory cells do this by storing a charge inside a device called a capacitor, using a single transistor to read or write that charge into said capacitor. The IBM superconductor memory circuit does not do that. It sets up a current circulating forever in a superconducting loop. The direction the current flows in indicates whether the memory cell is holding a 1 or a 0. IBM also showed it possible to put an array of such memory and logic devices onto a substrate using a series of deposition steps, though there were acknowledged challenges in uniformly applying the very thin layers involved. By the late 1960s, IBM had seen enough to initiate a research program to try and build a computer system out of these superconductor circuits. Their entry into this space spurred dozens of other programs at universities and labs. The NSA later got interested and contributed funds too, hoping that a Josephson computer could help break Soviet codes. Throughout the 1970s, the IBM Superconductor Computing Project focused on developing the technologies to integrate various Josephson junctions onto a single chip. Josephson circuits are patterned using the same tools as those used for traditional silicon ICs. You use lithography to transfer a pattern onto a substrate and use deposition to lay down the necessary layers for your chip. One of the most challenging parts of fabricating these junctions was putting down the insulating barrier in between the superconductors. For the Josephson effect to work, it needed to be a uniform 1 to 4 nanometers thick. One of the great things about silicon was its oxide, silicon dioxide. It's easy to grow and sits quite well on top of silicon. That was not the case with the Josephson junctions materials, so IBM had to develop a sputtering deposition method in low-pressure oxygen. The Josephson project was controversial within IBM itself. Established technologists there, like Rolf Landauer, criticized it, citing issues with noise, unreliability, and manufacturing. Why? Think back to a switch. A good switch is one that gives you a solid 1 or 0, on or off. Give it a weak flick, it still either flips on or off. It does not get stuck in the middle. If the device happens to take a weak input, it can't give a weak, uncertain output too. But that is what the first Josephson junction did. A resistive or superconductor state is not as strong an output. This is important because no fab can possibly make a perfect transistor trillions of times. There will inevitably be manufacturing variations. The silicon transistor's robust output, no matter the weakness of its input signal, gives you significant margins of error when dealing with those billions of transistors. Without that, you get unstable and unreliable outputs at high-volume manufacturing. The promise behind Josephson junctions and their ability to surpass silicon systems were based on a few arguments. First, Josephson junctions can seemingly switch far faster than silicon ever can, as little as 10 picoseconds. The argument is intuitive. Faster switching means faster processing speeds. Second, people foresaw power limits on silicon. Whenever a transistor switches, a bit of power dissipates as heat that needs to be carried away. The idea was that increasingly dense silicon chips would dissipate increasingly more power until consumption and heat generation surpassed what cooling systems can handle. By comparison, Josephson circuits dissipated orders of magnitude less power, just several microwatts. This presumably balanced out the inconvenience of dipping the whole computer into liquid helium. In 1977, a former IBM executive turned consultant was quoted in a Computer World article. In 7 to 8 years, we should expect 10,000 times greater performance from Josephson technology. A megabit storage chip will cost approximately $30 by 1985. Others hesitated to go that far, thinking that a 500 times improvement seemed more reasonable. In any case, the claims were that Josephson technology would unleash a flood of compute onto the world. As late as 1980, the IBM Josephson project team still believed that superconducting technology could build the next generation of fast computers. The superconductor computer managed to get to a stage where you had about 50 to 100 chips packed into a single core and immersed into liquid helium at temperatures of 4 Kelvin. But a few things happened. Silicon technology raced far faster ahead than anyone could have imagined, and IBM's superconductor technology did not pan out in the ways they thought it would. First, silicon chips continued to get denser and denser. Yet somehow, those denser silicon chips, with device counts surpassing the millions, did not consume proportionally that much more power. Why? Midway through the 1970s, Robert Dennard, inventor of the one-transistor, one-capacitor DRAM cell, proposed a scaling theory that we now call Dennard's Law. Dennard's Law says that if we physically shrink a transistor by some scaling factor, then the voltage needed to supply that scaled-down transistor also scales down by the same factor. This is because the transistor relies on electric fields in order to work, and a smaller transistor area requires a smaller electric field. So, end result, Dennard's scaling meant that power consumption per unit area of a die remains the same. So even if we stuff more transistors onto those unit areas, the chip's overall power consumption does not go up. Fueled by the ongoing PC revolution, microprocessor innovation started to go absolutely nuts. Chips were getting iterated on faster and faster, shaping up silicon to be a formidable competitor indeed. At the same time, the IBM team discovered a major limit on how fast their Josephson circuits can switch. Experiments found that the Josephson junction can switch very fast from a resistive state to a superconducting state in less than 10 picoseconds. This was good. But going in the reverse direction, from a superconducting state to a resistive one, was far slower, at least a few hundred picoseconds in a practical sense. This essentially gated any Josephson-based circuit to about 1 GHz, and by the early 1980s, it became increasingly clear that CMOS silicon chips were going to hit and surpass those speeds without needing to be dunked into liquid helium. Furthermore, there was a known issue known as punch-through. This is basically a small but non-zero possibility of the gate entirely failing to reset to a zero voltage state. In other words, the gate is, just like Brian McKnight, back at 1, a serious error issue. The final and most commonly cited reason why the IBM project sputtered out, though, had to do with memory. IBM was never able to get anything close to a large enough working memory for their computer. Without a fast memory to provide the logic circuits with data to run, the computer's speed is fundamentally capped. As I mentioned, IBM had created early versions of a memory cell that circulated a current in an infinite loop. IBM broadened that into two working concepts that could have created a computer. The problem was manufacturing and density. A DRAM cell is just two devices, a capacitor and a transistor. But a Josephson-based memory cell needed all sorts of inductors and resistors along with it, making it huge compared to a DRAM or even SRAM cell. So the team struggled to put enough good memory cells onto a single chip. By 1983, the best the team was able to do was about 1 kilobyte. 20 plus years later, in 2006, the best NEC in Japan could do was 4 kilobytes. In 1980, IBM put together an extended investigation on the progress of their Josephson computer project. A council of experts evaluated the Josephson team's progress as well as that of existing silicon technologies. They wanted to see if there was a possibility for Josephson to overtake silicon over the next 15 years. Considering the issues we spoke about earlier, 12 out of the 15 members voted not to continue. Thus, in 1983, IBM downscaled and eventually canceled its Josephson Junction project after 15 years and $100 million spent. Many felt it had gone way too long even then. The team of about 150 people in Yorktown Heights in New York State dispersed. These talents benefited other IBM projects like those on heads for hard disk drives. At about the same time, a team at Japan's telecom monopoly NTT picked up Josephson technology too. But despite a high-profile start, their project slogged on for 8 years before ending the same way. Today, there are few significant Josephson-based devices in people's hands, most notably superconducting quantum interference devices, or SQIDs. SQIDs leverage superconductivity sensitivity to magnetic fields to measure the presence of weak magnetic fields. They are regularly used in neuroscience, metrology, and detecting submarines. Because we have not overcome the manufacturing variation issues at scale, these systems are mostly analog. Such analog systems are characterized by their low device count. The issues with the IBM superconductor computer demonstrate many of the problems of creating brand new, alternate paradigms of compute. Silicon, for all its problems, works really well, and the trade-offs are not often slam dunks. But there is just something about the superconductor that really attracts attention and clicks. Adherents of superconductor computing have pointed to a new type of logic, rapid single-flux quantum, or RSFQ. Invented in Moscow in the mid-1980s, RSFQ replaces the flawed voltage-state logic paradigm with quantized magnetic flux pulses. I shall leave it at that. Today, RSFQ is the dominant form of superconductor digital logic, and it represents the next great hope for superconducting compute, and if we believe their proponents, compute in general. We shall see. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.